So good afternoon, everyone. How's the conference going so far? Good. I'm going to talk today about interface-driven architecture. And my presentation is going to be a little bit different. I don't have any fancy slides for you. And I'll explain why that is in just a moment, as soon as I get up my little... Oh, okay, good. Now, this isn't because I hate PowerPoint that I'm not showing you any slides. And this isn't a bold, creative, experimental move to at minimalism. But simply because I don't have any laptop to run my slides on. Now, you see that I do have a laptop, which was loaned to me by my friend Jeff Peters. But let me explain to you why I don't have a laptop with me. 2 weeks ago, I had a top-of-the-line Dell XPS Core 2 Duo. It was about 3 months old. It had 2 gigs of RAM. It had a fast hard drive. It was just decked out. It's like a $3,300 machine. But all that changed when I took a recent trip to Ottawa to teach a class at the Canadian government's request. And to make a long and pretty scary story shorter, after 24 hours in which everything I had was subjected to an intense search by the Canadian authorities, and they were convinced that I was a bad guy and demanded to know where is the file without ever telling me what the file is, and during which one fellow got led away in handcuffs. And I'll tell you, there's something, you see someone get handcuffed on television, it's one thing. When you see this shiny metal bracelet that's holding their hands together behind their back, it's a totally different experience. So I was subjected to this intense search. The Canadian government searched my laptop for 3 hours. They told me that there was prohibited material on it, although they never allowed me to see what the prohibited material was. And then they said that based on this, they were denying me entry into the country. They then took me over, two armed guards took me over to the Americans and said he has prohibited material. The Americans spent 3 hours searching my computer, couldn't find anything. Canadians came back to show them what the prohibited material was, couldn't find anything. But because this is a bureaucracy and because what you can't afford to do is admit to a mistake, they decided that they would just, the safest route was to seize my laptop. So my brand new, lovely $3,300 laptop is now in the State Department's possession, and I don't know if I'll ever get the thing back. If civil liberties...
That's the best excuse story I've ever heard.
The government ate my homework. So if civil liberties seem like an abstract concept and their abrogation a matter of concern for others, my experience has been that being on the receiving end of government power mixed with the assumption of guilt, because this was the really scary thing. No matter what I did, I was guilty. If I said something to them and tried to help them, I was obviously trying to mislead them, get them off the track. If I didn't say something, it was because I was guilty. And I think that this will change your idea when you hear about things like Homeland Security and the Patriot Act. It certainly changed mine. And being without a computer for a couple of weeks, which is what it's been now, is a pretty strange experience. I've had laptops with me for so long when traveling, even when I'm traveling on vacation, that the sudden absence of one leaves me with the continuous sensation that I've forgotten something. That something comfortable, even essential, that some part of me has been mislaid. And it's very off-putting. I mean, am I still a programmer if I'm not programming? Well, that's actually a question I've been thinking about a lot, even before my mishap with the Canadian authorities. I've been thinking about it because I'm convinced that this is a question that many of us are going to have to be asking ourselves in the next few years, this question of who am I? What does it mean to be a programmer? And it may be a question that causes us to rethink who we are and what we do and about the very nature of being a programmer. I read a book recently recommended to me by my good friend Clark Valberg that really got me started thinking along this line of reasoning. And the book is titled A Whole New Mind. The book's author, Daniel Pink, who wrote another very a big book, I'm trying to remember now the name of it. I can't remember it right now. But he surveys the landscape of business, and he finds three major trends: Asia, automation, and abundance. Now, if I were to use slides, I might show a slide of a cheap child's trinket with the label Made in Japan stamped on it. Because you see, when I was a child, the phrase Made in Japan meant cheap junk. I don't think there's probably anyone that's as old as I am in the audience. I'm 54 now. But when I was a kid, that was just a Made in Japan just meant junk. It was something that you saw only on the poorest of products. Now, of course, things have changed a lot since I was young. Dirt was invented, for example. The dinosaurs all turned into oil shales. And Made in Japan has become a badge of manufacturing quality. Now, Pink argues that things are going to continue to change, and particularly in the realm of outsourcing. The amount of outsourcing we see today is really just a harbinger of future change. Now, a few years ago, outsourcing had this big buzz, right? It was going to take all our jobs and all that sort of thing. And it's that buzz has died down. But what's happened is that outsourcing was not a fad that sort of came and went. Outsourcing has been integrated into the fabric of the way that companies do business. So that today we see service jobs, technical jobs, even professional jobs are shifting to the lower cost basis of Asia's skilled workers. You know, we sometimes think of outsourcing as the customer service. You know, you call and you get someone with a strong accent who tells you their name is Frank. You know, you're pretty sure their name really isn't Frank. But it's much more than that. And I believe that it's going to, we're going to see much more of this, and it's going to have a direct impact on the kind of work that we do. If Pink is right in his book, then what we're seeing with customer service, for example, is really just a beachhead in a much longer and more profound war. And speaking of war, one of my favorite quotes comes from the French military genius Napoleon, who was once asked about a particular battle that he was going to engage in, whose side he thought God was on. And Napoleon noted wryly, "I have observed," he said, "that God is most often on the side of the big battalions." And Asia has legions of highly trained, intelligent, experienced programmers, just like us. There's one big difference. They're willing to work at one-fifth what you're willing to work for. Those are pretty big battalions. As I said, I've been thinking about this for some time, and it seems to me that Pink is absolutely right in his analysis. Things are fundamentally changing. And times like these, when the underpinnings of what we know and the way that we work are essentially changing, are tumultuous. Our career as programmers, which just a few years ago seemed so solid with the internet boom, have become far less secure, and the firm ground that we thought we stood on has sort of turned into a roiling sea. So what are we to do? Now, we're not the first people to undergo... This always happens. Sorry about that. Remind me... Oh, for crying out loud. We're not the first people to undergo a radical shift, and we can perhaps learn from other people's past responses. So one common response is denial. Yeah, we've heard it all before. It's all doom and gloom. Things are going to be just fine. And one reason this response is so appealing is that most of the time, it's absolutely the right response. Many dire predictions never do come true. And reacting to each new scare will quickly drive us crazy or burn us out. So it's really important to assess how solid is the information the prediction is based on. Is it the result of analysis or is it simple fear? Is it a reasoned evaluation or just a way to sell us something? Right? So to answer to this, I urge you to read Pink's book. Or you might prefer The World is Flat by Thomas Friedman, another look at globalization and outsourcing. I can tell you that for myself, after thinking and studying this issue, I've come to the conclusion that outsourcing is neither a passing fad nor a minor adjustment to the way that we build software, but it's an entirely different model. And because I reason thus, I want to find a solution for me and perhaps for others whose analysis leads them to the same conclusion that mine did. And I'll get to that in just a moment, what I believe a solution may be. But first, let me suggest another possible answer to that challenge of how do we deal with the threat of outsourcing. And this answer seems particularly well-suited to our natural inclinations as developers. And that can be summed up, that solution, in the word more. If software developers in India or the Philippines or Ireland or whatever are willing to work for a fifth of what we want, we can try to make up the difference by doing more, by learning more skills, more languages, by going deeper into our craft. And the appeal to this is obvious, right? It only asks that we turn up the dial on what we've been doing and what's been successful for us today. And it has been working, right? We're gainfully employed. We hopefully enjoy our work. We have a sense of learning and doing new things. And these are all good things, so more of those would seem to be a fine strategy. But I believe there are deep and fatal flaws in this kind of thinking. First, it underestimates the vast cost difference between the two models. The one model being, I hire programmers here in North America, I pay them North American wages, and the other one is, I use outsourced labor. One uses and pays the going rate for so-called first world programmers. The other uses labor that costs 20% of the model, of the first model. Making up that difference simply is not possible by doing more. Secondly, it assumes that the outsourcing workers aren't themselves trying to do more, as they compete with other outsourcers for business. But they most assuredly are doing more. They're studying, they're working, and their governments are committed to helping them in this endeavor by funding low-cost but excellent education, offering tax cuts for outsourcing ventures, and providing favored treatment for training. That's an awful lot to overcome. Too much, I would argue, with a strategy of more. And then there's another strategy that I mentioned simply because it too has a certain naive appeal. And that strategy relies on the assertion that the cost differential between the two models is really meaningless. The argument goes something like this. Software, at least the kind of software we build, is not some plodding engineering work. It approaches art. And how does one value art? By the pound? Of course not. Nor should it be valued by the hour. Worrying about labor rates makes sense if your business is producing widgets, but it has no place in the realm of art. Wow, I feel so elite. You know, I'm not a programmer, I'm an artist now. I create works of staggering genius, functional art, if you will. My clients really should consider themselves fortunate to own a living work of art. But I do need those troublesome clients, and they seem to take a decidedly more commercial outlook on my output. Try as I might to convince them to the contrary, they think that if my software looks and works the same as another programmer's, and that other programmer's costs a fraction of what mine does, the smart business move is to go with the other guy. And when I try to explain to them that they're making an investment in art, they just look at me with the blank expressions like I'm crazy. They have this wacky idea that they should be clients rather than patrons. Now, I'm making fun of this sort of self-absorbed idea, but in fact, I've heard it put in terms that are not much dissimilar from what I've just said. Let's just say that the appeal is primarily to the programmer rather than to the client. So let me tell you the answer that I've arrived at and see if you think I'm onto something or simply out to lunch. When I ask myself, what is software? I find that there are really two parts to the answer. The most obvious answer is software code that runs on a computer, and of course that's a perfectly good answer as far as it goes. My argument is it doesn't go nearly far enough. The software's code argument leaves out the most important aspect of software. What code? And doing what? So software is not just code that runs, it's the right code that runs. But who determines what the right code is? Why, a software designer, right? Someone whose job it is to identify a client's problems in such a way that an automated solution can be designed and then built. The software's code argument fails, I believe, because it's only concerned with the fabrication of the software, and it leaves the design for others to consider. But let us be the ones to consider it, the architecture and design of the software, that is, because that's where the real value in software lies. In contrast, the fabrication of the software, the code, is far less important and far easier to achieve. And it is, in fact, a perfect choice for outsourcing. Design, on the other hand, is both very important and very hard. That it's important, I think we can all agree on. It's pretty obvious. The most carefully crafted code is useless if the software is either unusable or non-functional. But is design really hard? Well, it must be, or we wouldn't see so much bad software out there. Recently, as I was coming yesterday from Boston down here on Amtrak, I had my friend Clark, because I don't have a computer for reasons I've already explained, try to get me a ticket on Amtrak. It was a very frustrating experience. He clicked the wrong button, although who knew it was the wrong button, and everything we'd entered into at that point disappeared. And this is certainly not at all atypical. I was on Delta a few weeks ago getting that flight to Ottawa, had exactly the same experience. There's just tons of bad software being written. Even companies with big budgets who presumably should know better routinely produce software that annoys and frustrates users. And, you know, the biggest complaint that users have with custom software, the kind that most of us build, it doesn't work the way we do, they say. Or, as my friend Clark likes to say, is this what we're going to use? Well, of course, it doesn't. It makes perfect sense why we're producing bad software. And it's because what do we know about shipping packages or tracking customer concerns or our client's particular sales process? Damn it, Jim, we're programmers, not designers. But we try. We have meetings with customers. We listen to them. We produce some screens. But really, we need to get on with the work of fabrication. But wait a minute. If our fabrication costs are 5 times what a similarly skilled programmer can produce it for, then what we're selling, if what we're selling is fabricated code, we're in a pretty tough spot. We are competing now against people who are willing to work at 20% of what we are. But what if we aren't essentially fabricators? What if we are designers and architects? You know, the building trade already has this model worked out pretty well. When we talk about a Frank Gehry building or a Frank Lloyd Wright home, no one takes us to mean that either of the two Franks laid any bricks or hammered any nails. Right? Instead, they designed the building. It was their creative genius matched with their understanding of the needs of the fabricator that created lasting works of genius in their case. And the competent fabricators who implement their designs, who knows their names? I don't mean to disparage the craft of fabrication, but merely to point out the relative value of architecture and design versus fabrication. Can we redefine the nature of our work so that we do design and architect, and we leave implementation to others? Because if we can, we're no longer competing against these $15 an hour programmers who are very good. We're utilizing them. And it allows us to continue to work at a high level and continue to have high billable rates because we're producing real value. Now, my answer to this, can we do this, is yes, I think it's not only possible, it's necessary. India, the Philippines, Ireland, and a host of other countries are producing high-quality fabricators. They know all about Web 2.0. They use Ajax. Their database skills are top-notch. They learned object orientation when they were first learning programming, so it's just part of, and they work for 20% of what we will. So competing in the fabricating arena is pretty difficult. And as time goes on, it's likely to get more difficult. Economists talk about markets that are efficient. Now, when markets are young, they're typically inefficient, which means that the value that's associated with any particular commodity or service is sometimes out of whack. And this is often true. I don't know if you all remember back in the 80s when people like Ivan Boesky were doing program trading. Anybody remember that term? What was happening, I know because I did it myself, was that you could... there was an inefficient market, and you could buy one bundle of stocks on one exchange and sell it on the other exchange simultaneously and capture the difference, which was a risk-free transaction. It's known as an inefficient market. Well, the bad news is that over time, markets become more and more efficient. And what we have right now is an inefficient market. Why is it that the same SQL query costs $250 in one location and $38 in another one? The bad news is that markets become efficient. But it's not enough that we just hang out a new shingle and yesterday we were fabricators and today we're architects and designers. Good design is not about pretty screens or attractive colors. I mean, that is part of it, surely. But it's only a small part. At its heart, it's about translating the way that individual clients work, their business processes, into software that works the way users of that software work. Too often, the user interface gets relegated to the end of the project, and it's either left for a junior designer or someone who has really no skill and no passion for this. And this is why we see so much bad software. It's clear when you use some of the software that's written, and you don't have to go far at all to find it, just pretty much go to any website, that whoever has done this has no empathy for the user. They have not put themselves in the user's place. They haven't tried to perform tasks that a typical user would. And yet the entire purpose for software is to enable transactions between the user and the business. That's on the commerce side. Or if you're talking about internal processes, I worked with one very large company that after 6 months showed me they were doing interface-driven design, but they didn't have the users terribly involved. I know it seems kind of crazy, but what happened was the programmers would say, like, this is what you want, right? And the users were like, yeah, that looks right. And I've told this story, so if you've already heard it, I apologize for repeating myself, but it's an important story. I was brought in there to help them do the architecture on this thing. And I said, well, you know, humor me, and let's put one of the users in front of this screen. And I asked them to do something that they would typically do. Now, they'd been going through this for 6 months. Within 5 minutes, the user looked up and she said, oh, that won't work. And the developers were like, why won't it work? You know, it was because they didn't. This was for doing packages that had been returned and not been able to be delivered. And this is a very large package shipping company. And the problem was that from the developer's point of view, they would pick one individual package and then select a reason. The COD wasn't collected, there was a bad address, the customs form's incomplete, something like that, right? And so they would do it, and they would process one package at a time. But what the users were getting were pallets of, and so what they wanted to do was to select a number of individual packages, and then for maybe 40 or 50 at a batch, say, this is undeliverable because there was a COD. Why didn't they do that? Well, the developer didn't know that because they really hadn't studied the way that users were going to use it. And the users did not intervene, as you might think that they would, because they hadn't been asked to put themselves in that place. So what we had was something that looked like interface-driven architecture. And by that I mean that we start with the interface and we worry through the interface and we iterate through the interface, until we discover exactly the way users want, and we have no preconceived ideas about what our software should do. Right? All that we're concerned about with is saying to the user, does this work the way that you would expect it to work? And if what they tell us is no, then we know that we have a we need to go through another iteration. So the idea of interface-driven architecture is one in which we don't make architectural choices. We don't think about databases. We don't think about anything until we truly understand what the business needs are. Remember that for most of us, how many of you are dealing with companies that are your clients that are $500 million in sales or less? And how many of you are dealing with very large companies? Okay. Probably particularly here in D.C., probably got some. But whether the company is small or large, what differentiates one company from another? There's only a few ways that companies can compete. Right? They can compete on what's called product innovation. Think Apple. Here we're not trying to say that we're the most efficient company in terms of operational. You know, we're not the cheapest. We may even be a pain in the neck to do business with, but we've got killer products. Right? That's one strategy. Another one could be operational excellence, and think Walmart. I was in a Walmart recently. I haven't been in one in years. And I noticed two things. There's nobody around, and there's no signs. So that when I was looking for something, you're just sort of strolling around in this sort of cavernous warehouse kind of a thing. But you can't beat them on for cheap prices. And then the third model is what's called customer intimacy. And if any of you ever work with a company like Nordstrom's, you know, this is what's sometimes called high touch, where the company is going to make your experience of working with them so wonderful. And Nordstrom's is a great company as an example, because they will do crazy things to satisfy their customers. There are stories told of a woman buying a dress, and the dress she needed it within the next 2 hours. The manager drives out to the dressmakers, gets the dress hemmed, and drives another 45 minutes to deliver this thing, you know, at no extra cost. This is a separate model. Now, businesses that are smart will pick one of these areas and concentrate on it and leave the other two with merely marginal, barely acceptable standards. So, for example, a friend of mine recently bought something from Apple, an iPod, right? Tried to return it because it was broken, and had a nightmarish experience. So should Apple spend lots of their money to try to get their customer intimacy higher? No. There's a great book I recommend called The Discipline of Market Leaders. And in that, the authors say, really, really good companies concentrate on one of these, and only one. This is why you won't see lots of people at Walmart, and you will, because they are focused on one thing. There was a podcast recently I listened to about a fellow who wrote about Walmart, and he was talking about interviewing vice presidents for this book. And he would go into their offices, and the chairs for the visitors were plastic lawn chairs that cost $8 a piece. That when Walmart has their people traveling, they tell them to take the pens from hotels and bring them back. Why? It's because it's the whole ethic of saving money, and really good companies pick one of these and really, really focus on it. So whatever it is that our customers are focusing on, if our software is either generic or simply doesn't understand what it is, we are not producing real value. And we're going to run into the experience where people say, is this what we're supposed to use? And in fact, they won't end up using it. And they won't use it because their job is to produce value. And if our software doesn't align with what they're doing, so this leaves us with a tremendous opportunity. IDA is based on the idea, or interface-driven architecture, that the only people who can tell us how they want to interact with the software are the actual users. That no matter how smart or how logical the programmer is, they simply don't know what the business requires. This information is hidden. It's hidden from us, but it's also hidden from them, from our clients. We can't expect neat requirements documents. They can't write them, and if we write them, they won't be able to understand them. So again, look at what architects in the building trade do, and I think it'll provide an excellent model. So maybe you've never worked with an architect. In a former life, I was a cabinet maker, and I worked with architects a great deal. So let me quickly walk you through the process, and let's say you have an idea. You'd like a home built for yourself. So you do a little bit of investigation, and you find an architect whose work you like. Let's just call him Frank. Frank, you say, I'd like you to build me a house. Well, that's fine, says Frank. Let me ask you some questions. And so Frank does just that. He wants to know about your lifestyle. Do you entertain much? Do you have to plan for children? How many? Are there parents who are going to be living in the house? Do you have any special hobbies? Frank is going to ask you a lot of questions. But what makes Frank a great architect is that he's not a very trusting guy. He doesn't trust that you've really given him the information that he needs, that your answers are all that good. And he doesn't trust that he's necessarily understood all of your answers. So Frank does something very clever. He draws a picture of your house. It starts off as a sketch. Something like this, Frank says. And you look at it and you say, yeah, I'm not so crazy about stucco. Now, from Frank's expert point of view, the matter of the covering of the house, stucco, brick, slapstrake siding, shingles, whatever, is one of the least important ones. Very little is going to change depending on what you choose. But remember, Frank is a very good architect. He's really good. And he knows that to you, the matter of the house is apparent matters a great deal. So good architect that he is, Frank makes another sketch, and this time he substitutes bricks. More like this, Frank asks? Yeah, that's much better, you tell him. Now maybe you're thinking that Frank should have just asked, hey, do you like bricks or stucco? But Frank knows that there are a tremendous number of details about your house that neither of you have fully thought through. And that there are a tremendous number of details about your house, for some things depend on the choices that you'll make for other things. So rather than Frank trying to pepper you, remember he's not a very trusting guy. He knows that the best way for him to communicate with you is through something humans have used long before language was invented, and that's pictures. I know because language was invented just after dirt was when I was a kid. And so little by little, Frank works with you to help both of you discover the home that you really want. With each iteration, right, with each sketch, you're going to get closer to exactly what you want, but you have been unable to articulate to Frank. And after each iteration, you'll look at the picture, or after enough iterations, you'll look at the picture that Frank's come up with and said, that's it, Frank, that's exactly what I imagined. Of course, you imagine no such thing. It was the process that Frank led you through that made explicit what was hidden even from you. And Frank is, as I said, quite an architect. But Frank isn't done, though. As important as design is, that design now must be turned into a set of architectural drawings that provide clear direction for any fabricator on how to implement that design. Frank has moved from his design mode to his architecture mode. And he's now concerned with the structural details. He must draw on all of his knowledge of how buildings are fabricated to make sure that the design is, in fact, buildable. Once this work is done, then your home can be bid by several skilled fabricators. Now, these fabricators call themselves builders, just as software fabricators call themselves programmers. But in both cases, fabrication can only proceed once the design and architecture are done. We want skilled fabricators, of course, but it's the design and architecture that make the house truly yours. So my question is, can software work the same way? My experience is that it can. Interface-driven architecture emulates the process we just saw Frank going through. We begin by asking questions, but like Frank, we don't trust much in the answers that are given. What the answers do give us is a good starting point. In IDA, we don't begin with a sketch, necessarily, the way Frank used, but we begin with the first cut of the user interface. Now, behind the user interface, there's nothing. There's no code, there's no modules, there's no database. And we know that this is rough, and we know it's going to change and probably change drastically. But it does give us a starting point, and maybe more importantly, a means of shared communication, where, like Frank, we can say to our client, something like this. Now, the chances of hitting it right the first time are pretty slim. But we know this, and we're not discouraged. What we've done is set up a situation where clients can give us meaningful feedback. The reason that this works is that to the user, the interface is the application. Before IDA, I got meaningful feedback all right. It just came at the wrong time. And that was when the software was deployed and the client first saw it. And I used to dread hearing these words from a client. You know what would be nice? I was tempted to say, yes, what would be nice is if you told me this several weeks ago. But let's think back to how Frank handled you as his client. He didn't ask for a detailed specification or requirements document. He walked you through a series of sketches, getting your feedback on each sketch. And from that, both you and he discovered exactly what you want. The same is true of software done in the IDA way. Both the designer, architect, and the client discover what they want. They do so in a safe and inexpensive manner. Excuse me. They do it by altering the user interface. One of the problems with altering a design is that when there's code behind it, it's very expensive. And I have seen programmers, and you or I may have actually been guilty of it once or twice, resisting a change because we know that the seemingly innocuous change is going to mean major changes to the underlying structure. IDEA says, let's find out exactly what clients want before we ever build anything. I've often said that clients are typically involved in two phases of the development cycle. At the beginning of the cycle, right? We have those early meetings with them and find out what they want. Then it's really too early for them to give us any meaningful feedback. Because one thing I have learned is that clients cannot tell us what they want until they see what they want. The other time that clients are usually involved is at the end of the cycle when we've deployed the software, and now it's too late for them to give us any meaningful feedback. Right? All the time and the money have been used up. IDEA changes that dynamic. It provides a means for collaboration and cooperation between the developer and the client. It can help remove the combative nature of much client developer interaction by letting clients make changes repeatedly. Since we're only changing the interface, those changes are cheap and can be done quickly. In fact, using IDEA, we encourage clients to provide feedback so that we can better understand the needs of the business and the way users or workers will use the software. Now, this is not a matter for unengaged architects. This is not sort of letting users design their own software. Because if we're doing our job, we are understanding what their business needs are, and we know something that users don't know. What is possible that can be done with software? Perhaps it means simply automating their existing process, but it also may mean doing something radically different, introducing new technology. This is where we can use our creativity and where we are no longer competing with who can write code for $20 an hour. By really putting ourselves, we have a tremendous advantage. Right? We are in front of the client. We can shadow, we can mirror their workers as they work and see what it is they're doing. And we can use our understanding of both the client's business and our understanding of what's possible in software to design software that produces enormous value. We are no longer competing on price. We are using our creativity. We are using our skill, our mind as designers and as visioneers, if you will. This process of iterating through the user interface and refusing to prematurely get into the architecture of an application really allows us the space for clients to come to the decisions that they need. I imagine that more than one of you have had the experience of thinking that you understand what clients want, going along, and then finding midstream that the clients start wanting something different. Anyone ever had that experience? Oddly, it seems to be a fairly common one. This used to frustrate me enormously until I realized that this is the natural process that clients go through to figure out what they want. They're not software engineers. They're not software designers. But what we can do is apply our creativity, make suggestions, and put these in a format that users can try them out. As I say, it's not merely a matter of, this is not sort of let the users design the software, because it's not like they understand. At best, they're probably going to try to simply automate what they have, and sometimes that's by no means the best method to do it. But by providing this feedback mechanism where we try something out, maybe something radically different, and the users can live with this for a couple of weeks and try it out. We're going to get very interesting answers to the question, what is it users really want? It provides this process for discovery, and it's the best way that we found to date of achieving really successful software projects. But I especially want to recommend IDEA to you because of the threat of outsourcing. And I say threat, but whether it's a threat or a promise really depends on our point of view. I find that the availability of inexpensive fabrication can be a great boon to us. If my job is not to write code, but my job is to deliver software, and I can find someone who can write high-quality software at a fifth of what I'm willing to write it for, why exactly am I writing software? Or why am I writing code? It becomes almost a matter of self-indulgence. I write it because I enjoy writing it. That's very good. But realize that I'm taking money out of my pocket or out of my company's pocket because I enjoy writing code. Maybe it would be better for me to write code on my own or to do what I call R&D programming so that for the next job and to outsource the fabrication. Now these outsources are no longer a threat. They really become a boon. I can compete with other developers and provide a really high-quality product without charging an enormous amount of money because my cost differential is so much better. Now, this isn't to say that there are no hiccups along the way, right? Working with outsourced fabricators can be problematic. There are language barriers, there are culture barriers, and just the aspect of everything being remote allows for misunderstandings. Small outsourcing firms can be open one day and close the next. So using outsource for fabrication is not necessarily easy, but it very well may be vital. And if your company is new to this, well, then I would suggest that you consider partnering with a developer that's already successfully navigated the rocky coast of that. There are dangers, but as I see it, the biggest danger of all is ignoring this sort of mega trend of outsourcing and continuing along as we've done before, thinking of ourselves as our value as writers of code and making no preparation for what appears to be this fundamental shift in the nature of what we do as developers. Now I would like to ask you folks for any comments or questions or experiences that you've had and just sort of throw this open to development. Peter? Absolutely do. One of the biggest issues that I run into is that clients are quick to say, yeah, that looks great. And after a while, I've developed a certain sense, you know, that they're being as honest as they can, but they haven't really thought through the thing. So I will introduce twists into the situation. Do you think it's ever possible that we might want to do so-and-so? And they'll go like, yeah, I could see that we might. How would you do that? What would you expect to see? Or I will ask them to perform tasks. That's one of the biggest things. Is the problem with this big shipping company is that the clients were in a passive mode. You know, they were looking at screens, going like, it looks good, it looks good, it's pretty, I like the color. You know, could you make the buttons more rounded? Yeah, we can do that. Yeah. Right? But so by putting them in that situation and by refusing, this is what I mean. As the architect and designer, we do not have a passive role. I sometimes call ourselves Sherpas. You know, we've got these greenhorns who want to get to the top of Everest, and they don't know the dangers. They don't know the high failure rate for custom software. You know, they don't know what they're going to encounter, but we should, and we should guide them. And part of that is not allowing them. You know, there was I've told the story before, too. There's a famous story of a guide who let the clients drive the process. This group of travelers was setting off across a known course with an experienced guide when they got tired of the process and thought, this is just taking too long, something that clients I found are very want to do. So they were able to convince the guide that they could find a shortcut. I'm quite sure that most of you have heard of this this group of travelers who went through this process and decided to run the exploration themselves. Anyone know who I'm talking about? Who? Donner Party, exactly. And ended up eating themselves, which is a pretty apt description for some projects that I've been involved in. So this is not something where you go passive or you sort of your job is relegated to just sort of taking notes. Clients, they are somewhat like children. You know, they get enthusiastic, they want to do things that sometimes are not in their best interest. And a lot of what my job consists of and a lot of what IDA asks of us is that we really put our clients' needs first, even when we end up having sometimes to fight a little bit with our clients. Of course, you want to do it in the nicest possible way, but you know that your job ultimately is to get them from this point A to the top of this big mountain. And you know that if you allow them to run the process themselves and to tell you when things are ready, they will tell you very quickly, this looks great. And if you, and the, maybe the first few times you try this, you'll believe them. Because maybe it looks great to you, too. You haven't had a lot of experience working like this. You will quickly find that, in fact, you didn't do nearly enough. I worked on one job that took 7 months, and it was not until the beginning of the seventh month that any production code was written. And it turned out to be enormously important that I hadn't done any production code, because we learned from a guy in a warehouse something that altered everything. It altered the database. It altered the modules that we wrote, right? So this is, Peter, this is what I would say is you have to be very wary of clients who will typically, sometimes developers think like, well, that'll take forever. But that's not the real danger. The danger is the clients will be like, looks great, go ahead. Right, so one of the things that IDA says is you continue through this process until you can tell the client, you have given me everything that I need to architect this job. And the client can honestly tell us, you have shown me everything I expect to see, and there's nothing different that I would change. Yes, sir. It kind of depends. No, I don't use Photoshop because I want a real clickable thing, and so I will typically use HTML or Flex or Flash or, you know, some JavaScript, and absolutely right. And so what will happen is, like, let's say that you're trying to show them how to delete a user, right? There may be 20 users displayed on the screen, only which as the delete link only works for one of them, right? Everything else is grayed out. So that's the only one they can click. They click it. All it does is go to a new page on which that user's name no longer appears. No database, and it's very important that we not make any kind of architectural commitments early, because it will prevent us from allowing the users to make radical changes. Whereas if we're not committed to any architecture, this is one of the dangers, I think, about focusing so much on things like frameworks. And I don't know if I'm a big framework fan. But one of the dangers of this is that we start focusing on things that clients aren't paying for. Clients don't care whether we use Mach 2 or Model Glue or whether we're using React or ColdSpring. These are things that we do to make our code more robust and to make our jobs easier. But what's really important is that the client get the software that they want. So by focusing on aspects of making sure that the user has had that time that they need, and that time means that we do not make premature architectural decisions, then we really will come up with much, much better designs. Yes, sir. Sure. You can wireframe things. I use wireframing much less now than I used to, Because wireframing is only helpful to get me that first iteration of the user interface. A wireframe is simply like a text-based, clickable HTML thing, which may be fine. But what I found that developers, because I used to teach that a lot, what I found developers did was that we love logic and we love processes, you know, which is good given what we do for a living. But the problem is that it's sort of like getting on a train track. People want to start with the wireframe, and then they want to have code that automatically takes the wireframe and generates, you know, whether it's Fusebox or whatever it is. And this is necessarily a messy part of the whole process. It's something that people need to run into each other at the water cooler and discuss, and it will take weeks to really figure out what they want. But I will promise you that if you don't do it now, it will occur later on. And it's typically after all the time has been spent. So my feeling now is let's get to the beginning of the user interface. Let's do it really quickly. And when people make changes, a client says, and clients will typically start with changes that are just like we were talking about, you know, that you said, like, I don't like stucco. Right? Frank doesn't say, like, that doesn't matter. You know, that's not important. What I want to know is, do you like the rooms? You know? So if a client says, like, yeah, if you could make that button more rounded, I'll make that button more rounded and have it ready for him the next day. You mean like this? Yeah, I'd like it to be more on the left, so I put it on the left. He goes, no, on the left. I go, oh, your other left, of course, you know. And keep going through these iterations. The real temptation is going to be to think the important thing is to get to writing code. That's not the important thing. The important thing is writing the right code. Bonnie. My experience has been, you know, Abraham Maslow came up with this sort of hierarchy of needs back in, I think, the 50s, and said that until people have their physical needs met, you know, for shelter and food, they can't go on to their emotional needs. And until their emotional needs are met, they can't get to self-actualization and all that. My experience has been that to clients, the most important things initially are things like the color and the shape of the buttons and the placement of the buttons. And even though we know that it's immaterial, to the clients, for at least the clients that I deal with, it's a big deal. And so by allowing them to make those changes and making them very, very quickly, and they may change them back. Oh, no, I guess we do want them along the bottom. Fine, we'll put them back along the bottom. Very, very, very cheap. Once I have satisfied those needs, now I can, because I used to say, like, never mind that. Let's just imagine what's important about the data. And they go like, oh, yeah, okay. Could that background be gray? You know? And I go like, And then I realized, like, well, instead of me trying to get clients to do something they're not comfortable with, let me get those needs met. Let's work out, because I'm going to have to do it anyway. Right? Let me get that settled. And now that they're comfortable in that environment, because clients aren't used to thinking about the structure of something. They're more, it's like I say, the user interface is the application. And rather than, you know, I mean, I've tried all sorts of things, showing them flow charts, showing them UML, showing them ER diagrams. And the most successful thing that I found is emulate Hollywood. You know, what they do, what Hollywood does is it produces sets that look like the real thing but aren't. You know, so in the, what was it, Independence Day when they blew up the White House? As I came into town, I found that the White House is in fact still there. So apparently, that was a set, and that by doing this, at least in my experience, this has been much more successful than trying to get clients to concentrate on what's important to me. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
This is a big problem, particularly when you're working with big companies or governmental things, where they have interposed a layer between the users. And sometimes for understandable reasons, they may have hundreds of thousands of users. Right? And so you can't obviously get them all into it. In that situation, now I have the advantage of not necessarily, because I don't work for someone, I can turn down a job. But what I have tried to do and tried to help other people with is find someone who's really passionate about having a successful project. You know, these project managers or whatever they call themselves, liaisons with the client, and explain to them in detail the problems of building software. And be very candid about the failure rates on custom software and say, here are the reasons why software fails. And try to get them to buy into the process so that they still have that role, but their role is no longer to interpose a layer between them and the users, but to facilitate your interaction with those users.
What about doing kind of task-oriented, simple usability tests with them?
Very important in using software, you know, that allows you to track and measure how that sort of thing works is very necessary. Because you don't want to just rely on users saying, that looks nice. You really want to, how does it, you know, can they do it? How easy for them is it, to perform some task? And that, I think that's a very important part of the aspect, is to come up with what are sometimes called user stories or use cases, and ask users to do this with the interface. You'll find out very quickly whether they're simply saying, I like the color of the screen, or this is really a usable design. Yes, sir? Right. Right. Clark, you so, you know, I hope that as you think about this, that you will really take seriously the issue of outsourcing. And I highly recommend Pink's book, A Whole New Mind, because I think it will change the way. Pink's argument is a much broader one than what I've outlined. He says that in the information age, which he believes is drawing to a close rapidly, people like us, the left-brained, logical analysts, ruled the roost. He said in the new age, the people who are going to rule the roost are the creative people, the designers, the storytellers, the people that, because he talks about abundance and says that the needs, the fundamental needs, like Maslow's hierarchy, have been met for so many first world countries. The needs are no longer more features and more gadgets or more, a higher quality product or not necessarily even a cheaper product, but something that helps us define ourselves. When I was a kid, the idea that you would wear clothing with someone's name on them, a designer's name, was crazy. I mean, why in the world would you do that? You know? Now, and it's, we, of course, we do that, and we do it because the choices that we make about the products says how we think about ourselves as people. You know, Apple has such a rabid fan base, not because it necessarily produces the highest quality products, but because people like what it says about them. And this can be true even for the software that we create, where we can end up with people who want to work with us because we're no longer competing on price. And we certainly don't want to compete on, you know, my framework can beat up your framework. You know, what we want to do is be able to go into a business and say, this is the kind of success that we have enabled other businesses to have. So I really hope that you'll think seriously about this. I'm not suggesting that outsourcing is going to eat all our jobs, but I am suggesting that markets become more efficient. And I think that we've even seen that with the internet bubble bursting and salary, you know, now the web is getting hot again and is a tremendous time for us. But if we define ourselves as coders, that our value consists in writing code, we are competing with $15 an hour, excellent programmers. These are not bad programmers. These are people. One of the things when I have gone overseas to teach that I'm struck by is the much higher quality of education in other countries than what American programmers have. It's unsettling, quite honestly. People from Singapore, people from India, people from England, they already know and are completely comfortable with the things that a lot of American programmers are still struggling with. So I don't want you to get the sense that these are people who can maybe write forms but do nothing else. In fact, I think we would all be pretty horrified if we actually pitted our skills against some of these $15 an hour people. So thank you very much for coming.